Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our sixth look at the Ypsilanti murders. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you want to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast. Also, you can go to your favorite podcast app, leave a 5-star review, or go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for $1.99 a month, you can get access to early ad-free shows, just as my first two Patreon subscribers, Channel and Anthony, did. Now, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We left off last time. The police were taking a very close look at John Norman Collins, but also at his roommate, Arnold Davis. They learned about a trailer that had been rented and not returned, and that Davis and Collins resembled the individuals said to have rented these trailers. The police looked into Davis's background and discovered that both he and Collins had worked at a subsidiary of Goodyear where they manufactured brake drums. Although, according to records, Davis had quit the previous May, at which point he had taken a room at 619 Emmett Street, while Collins had quit that job during the middle of June. Davis was described by co-workers as an individual who was difficult to get to know. He was very closed-mouthed, even suspicious in his activities, and most people who knew him considered him to be rather dull-witted. Although right around this point in time, Davis seems to have disappeared completely, and it was going to be a little while before the police were going to be able to track him down. While they were trying to do that, however, they continued to look into John Norman Collins, talking to various ex-girlfriends as well as women who had worked with him at the brake plant. A woman claiming to be Collins' girlfriend stated that on the day of the final murder, she and Collins had been supposed to go swimming. However, he never showed up and never gave her an explanation as to why he had stood her up. She further told police that she had met Collins the prior March when she was at a car wash, washing her car, and Collins had driven his motorcycle in. They began talking, and when Collins learned that she had just purchased a motorcycle, he informed her that it'd be really cool if they went out and rode together, becoming a regular couple until roughly the middle of June. When questioned as to whether or not there were any strange behaviors she observed in Collins, this young woman stated she couldn't think of anything. He was usually quite the gentleman. Another girlfriend stated that while Collins could be fun, he was extremely oversexed. She described an incident where she had encountered Collins while coming out of the school library. He had walked her home, at which point they began making out. And when Collins discovered that she was on her period, he informed her, quote unquote, "That is really disgusting," and stormed off. She told the police that they had not gone out since that point. Another young woman said that she had ridden with Collins on a number of occasions, and that he was almost always well-behaved. She stated that on one of these trips, they had stopped in a wooded area, and Collins asked her out of nowhere whether or not she would be scared if he was the Ypsilanti Ripper. When she pretended to act frightened, this woman said that Collins just stared at her blankly, which made her feel uneasy. And after a few moments, they decided to continue on with their ride, and nothing more was said about the incident. Still another young woman told police that she had known Collins for a considerable period of time and always found him respectful and rather attractive. However, at a fraternity party, the two of them were dancing together when Collins asked her whether or not she was religious, to which she replied, yes, and Collins seemed to grow disgusted and asked her how she could slow dance with a man in such a manner if she were. The woman, thinking that he was playing, pulled him closer, telling him that it depended on the man, at which point Collins pushed the young woman away, snarling at her before storming off. Later that evening, Collins apologized to her before going into a rant about how he did not believe in any of the Ten Commandments, specifically the Fifth Commandment, Thou Shalt Not Kill, and that the perfect crime to him was one where there was no guilt. All of these things start to paint a picture of John Norman Collins that is in stark contrast to the public face that he gives. Looking over his academic career, they come across a passage that Collins had written, which really began to describe him. And in fact, if you go looking for John Norman Collins, you'll almost certainly find this passage. It reads, quote, "If a person wants something, he alone is the deciding factor of whether or not to take it, regardless of what society thinks may be right or wrong. For example, if a person sees a piece of jewelry or something that he likes in a store window, it is up to him to smash the store window or not, to take it or not, and up to his own intellect if he gets away with it or not. It's the same if a person holds a gun on somebody. It's up to him to decide whether to take the other's life or not. The point is, it's not society's judgment that's important, but the individual's own choice of will and intellect." They also began learning that Collins had ties to most of the victims. That in 1967, he had worked in an office part-time directly across the hall from the first victim, Mary Therese Flezer, that he swam in the same lakes as one of the other victims. Then Joan Elspeth Schell had not only worked in the same university building as Collins, but had also lived across the street from him. Police also had to contend with the fact that at least two individuals fingered John Norman Collins as being the young man that Miss Schell was last seen with. There were many other links between Collins and his victims. They'd found that he ran in the same social circles as some of them, that he frequented a bar that one of the victims was known to go to. Then police get a tip concerning 16-year-old Marilyn Skelton. The janitor at a place that Skelton frequented came to police and informed them that the sketch of the man wanted for questioning in the disappearance of Karen Sue Benneman resembled a man that he had often seen at the apartment complex where Skelton frequently crashed. The man stated that, well, this individual did not go to the same apartments as Skelton. He was there quite often. When shown a photograph of Collins, the janitor stated, well, it could be him. He could not swear with absolute certainty that the man in the picture was the same one that he had seen over at the apartment complex. Police learned that the occupants of the apartment that Collins frequently visited had moved out at some point in June. Something that's not often talked about is the fact that the police discovered that at least three of the known victims were menstruating during the point at which they were killed, and that according to medical records, it was inconclusive as to whether or not the other four were menstruating as well, but that they could have been. And they began to postulate that this was the reason that the murders had actually been committed. With all of this, Collins is put under 24-hour police surveillance. They noted that on the second night of surveillance, while he and his roommate Davis were out driving around in Collins' car, the two men stopped over at the home of Collins' uncle, State Trooper David Leake. It appeared to the surveillance team that no one was home, as Collins let himself into the house using a key, was inside for roughly 20 minutes, exiting the main building at one point to go into the garage where a dog could be heard barking before going back into the house, exiting a few moments later, locking the door behind him. The next day, Collins was not seen until around noon, at which point he does not appear to have done much beside driving out towards Detroit to his mother's home in Centerline, where he washed his car, hung out with his mother, his sister's child, and did not reappear until the next day. The following day, Collins' mother left for work, and he did not appear until the early afternoon, at which point he did some grocery shopping and returned to his mother's home, mowing the lawn, had dinner when his mother returned home, visited some neighbors before returning back to Ypsilanti. Police gave no indication outwardly that they were, in fact, zeroing in on the man they believed to be responsible, but internally, they believed that John Norman Collins was the perpetrator of these murders. The next day, however, law enforcement got a shock when the governor enacted a rarely used law that allowed for the governor to put the state police in charge of all local police activity, basically flipping the bird at the local constabulary and letting them know that he was not pleased with the work that they were doing. Now, on this same Wednesday that the governor makes this decision and enacts this law, something is going on that neither local law enforcement nor the public has any idea of. John Norman Collins's aunt, the wife of State Police Sergeant David Leake, was down in the basement of the family home. They had returned the following day from a vacation. So as Mrs. Leake is in the basement, she notices splotches on the floor, dark splotches that lead from the entry into the recreation room over into the corner where the dryer was sitting. Now, in this corner was a stepladder that was often used, and on this stepladder, too, there were black splotches. Mrs. Leake knew that these dark spots were not on the floor when they had left 12 days prior, as just before they had gone on vacation, she had brought all of her sons down into the basement and given each of them a haircut. Mrs. Leake thought that her husband may have done this, as he had been painting that evening as she and the boys prepared for the vacation. Later that morning, as she and her husband are at the table in their kitchen, she brings up these dark splotches on the floor, letting him know that he needs to clean them up before he leaves. The husband goes down into the basement with his wife and insists that that is not his doing, that he had been using white paint, and this is obviously black paint. Upon closer examination, Officer Leake realizes that it appears to be flat spray paint. Knowing that he'd had a can of spray paint somewhere in the basement, Officer Leake goes to look for it and is surprised when he cannot find it. His wife points out the paint that is on the ladder, and Officer Leek insists that that was not there when they left. The two of them begin looking around the basement and discover that a number of items are missing. An empty box of laundry detergent, ammonia. After checking the rest of the house, Officer Leek informs his wife that he believes that his nephew, John Norman Collins, has taken these items for some reason, has also used the paint in their basement. They discover a t-shirt in the basement, soaking wet, covered in small pieces of hair from the haircuts. Collins was very close with this aunt, uncle, and their children. There are other things, too, that stuck out to the Leeks. A note that his aunt had left telling him about a half-eaten watermelon that was in the fridge if he wanted it was ignored, as was the watermelon, as was a note his uncle had left down on the fuse box letting Collins know that if he wanted to use the air conditioning, he just had to put a new fuse in. Mrs. Leek also noticed that a shirt that she had hung from a water pipe in the basement had brown splotches on one of the sleeves, which she knew had not been there prior to them leaving for vacation. Later that evening, as the children were put to bed, Mr. and Mrs. Leek discussed the situation, and Mrs. Leek let him husband know that she had tried to call James, but he was out for the evening. Not long after this, the police barracks in Ypsilanti that Sergeant Leek was assigned to contacted him, asking him to come into that evening as there was something that they needed to discuss with him. It's upon arriving at the police barracks that Sergeant Leek learns that his nephew, John Norman Collins, is the primary suspect in the investigation. Obviously, Detective Sergeant Leek is stunned to hear this news and finds it incredulous when his chief fills him in on the details, all the things that the local police have gathered on John. He then informs the chief of the barracks about the little things that had gone missing while they were away, and lets him know that they have been unable to reach their nephew all day, which was odd, as John really was a part of their family. Eventually, Detective Sergeant Leek learns that his nephew is at his mother's house in Centerline. Arriving home, he learns that his wife had tried the boarding house again, and this time had talked to John's roommate, Davis, who said that he believed Collins was at his mother's home. They attempt to reach him there, only to learn that he is out at the moment. Collins calls back later, at which point they present him with this questions about the paint in the basement. Collins swears he didn't do anything. Collins swears he did not do anything, he did not touch anything, that he had only gone in the basement at one point to check the water heater and to make sure the windows were closed, and that anything that might be missing or out of sorts in the house could not have possibly been his doing. Officer Leek would later state that after getting off the phone with their nephew, he felt uneasy, so he decided to go meet with a colleague from the local barracks. He didn't believe their house had been broken into, but he felt strongly that something was seriously amiss concerning his nephew, the murder investigation, and the missing items from their house. After going out for a few drinks and explaining to one of his colleagues all of this, the two men go back to the Leek home and they went down into the basement to investigate further. Using a screwdriver, they began to scrape away the blotches of paint and discovered what appeared to both men to be blood stains underneath. Leek said nothing to his wife or to any of his colleagues the following morning when he went back to work. until the station commander arrived, at which point Leek went into the man's office and informed him of what he had discovered underneath the paint stains in the basement. At this point, both officers head over to the crime center, i.e. the task force that had been set up, to fill in Captain Walter Stevens, who was a 29-year veteran of the state police department. So, they inform this man of everything that they have discovered at the Leek's home. He insists on being driven out there, and upon seeing everything, including the stains on the shirt in the basement, decides that he needs to be brought back to the crime center. At which point, it is decided to send the crime scene technicians to the Leek house to investigate the basement further. Now, upon returning to his house, Detective Leek finds his wife on the phone with Collins, who's asking them if they've discovered anything concerning the paint. Leek tells his wife that they don't have anything, but that the lab technicians are on their way over. She relays this information to her nephew before getting off the phone with him and informing her husband that Collins is anxious to know how everything turns out, and then asks her husband why the crime scene technicians are on their way to the house, at which point Detective Sergeant Leek informs his wife that he and a colleague had removed some of the paint the previous evening, and it appeared to them that there were blood stains beneath the paint, at which point the detective informs his wife that their nephew is the primary suspect in the Ypsilanti Ripper slayings. Obviously, this hits his wife hard. She goes into hysterics, and Detective Sergeant Leek eventually is able to get his wife to go upstairs into the bedroom, out of view of both their children as well as the arriving crime scene technicians. The technicians arrive around 11 a.m. Now, these stains in the basement are tested and found to be inconclusive, meaning they cannot tell whether or not these stains in the basement are in fact blood. The crime scene technicians are getting ready to leave when one of them saw something over between the washing machine and the dryer. What the man had discovered were hundreds of tiny little hair clippings. If you'll recall, when the body of Karen Sue Brenneman was discovered, over 300 hair clippings were found on her underwear. Now, after studying these hairs, it was determined that they had come from a male whose hair had been cut with a pair of clippers. Now, these hairs are going to end up being matched with those discovered in the Leek family basement. Initially, police thought that these clippings may have come from a barber shop. However, they didn't feel that that was the right avenue, and they eventually gave up in pursuing it. After using small hand vacuums, the crime scene technicians were getting ready to leave again when one of them bent down, making certain that they'd gotten everything from around the washer, when he noticed another red stain. This one, however, did not appear to be what was later determined to be wood varnish, but in fact looked to the technician like dried human blood. Testing it on site, they determined that it was in fact human blood. They then began to go over the basement yet again, finding more in the corner on the floor where the dryer was, another on the wall near the washing machine, as well as those on the sleeve of the shirt that was hanging down there. When the technicians inform Detective Sergeant Locke of what they have found and that they are going to have to contact the task force, he says to them that it's probably about time they picked his nephew up. They inform him that this is in fact the case so long as he has not fled the area. Leek informs them that they had seen Collins drive by the house about an hour prior on his motorcycle. And Leek informs them that it's his belief that his nephew probably knows that something is going on. Some more crime scene technicians are called. The main technician on scene goes to meet with the captain. It's decided that while the technicians go over the house further, Detective Sergeant Leek is going to go meet with his nephew. After sending his wife and sons to one of her sister's house for the rest of the day, Leek contacts Collins and sets up a meeting with him. Now they have this meeting at Collins' rooming house with another officer as well as the head of the task force present. They speak with Collins for over an hour. Later, the officers would state that John Norman Collins' responses were robotic, without emotion. Collins eventually agrees to be polygraphed. This after breaking down in tears and lets them know that he wants his lawyer present. Eventually, Collins' lawyer arrives. Collins has read his rights, and then a round-robin tournament of interrogation begins on John Norman Collins, involving all of the various law enforcement agencies that had been seeking him or someone resembling him since the final murder had taken place. In this interview, Collins barely responds to anything officers say beyond a yes or a no, throwing in an occasional I don't know. All of this is leading to a rather dramatic scene. One of the crime scene technicians ends up taking pictures of Collins while his lawyer is distracted talking to the officers. This enrages Collins' lawyer, who begins to drag him out of the police station, at which point a phone call comes in informing the police that they may proceed with arresting John Norman Collins and charging him with murder. This is roughly 11:30 that night. The police seize two of Collins' motorcycles as well as his car to be searched for evidence. And eventually they get search warrants to search Collins' living quarters on Emmett Street. These last warrants were signed at 10 a.m. that Friday morning. Little was found inside of his room beyond a half-used can of spray paint and a box of rounds for a .22 caliber handgun. They also found numerous types of knives and cutting utensils. Officers begin to question one of Collins' roommates, who begins telling them a rather disturbing story. They had gone out the previous Friday night, and upon returning, Collins had realized he forgot to close his car windows. So this roommate follows Collins back down to the car as he does this. Then Collins takes a cardboard box from the trunk of the car. There's a green wool blanket over the top of the box. Collins brings both box and blanket up to his room. According to this roommate, they're in the room for a period of time watching television, at which point Collins gets up, goes into the bedroom portion of his living quarters with the box, and comes out a short time later, telling his roommate that he's going out for a while. The roommate, seeing that Collins' hands are full with this box, stands up to open the door for him and gets a glance inside of this box. He tells the officers that there was a woman's shoe, in which appeared to him to be maroon in color, inside of the box, along with a woman's purse and a rolled-up pair of blue jeans. Collins leaves, returns about a half hour later, and when asked what happened to the box, Collins informs his roommate that he'd simply decided to get rid of it. Unfortunately, when officers returned to the house on Emmett Street, they were unable to find any of these items. Now, you might be thinking, why would they check there? Well, to the best of their knowledge, Collins had not left the building for the rest of the night. Remember, he was under police surveillance at this time. We'll be back in just a moment. You've heard me talk about it before, peeps and freaks. Chinese Mandarin is the number one in-demand language globally in the international job market. And I have a brand new sponsor this week just for you. Chinese teacher Mary. Mary goes deep into learning Mandarin, much the same way I go deep into covering true crime cases, ensuring that every single student not only understands pronunciation and sentence structure, but that they can differentiate between tones, read the language, and speak it fluently. I have never come across another Chinese teacher quite like Mary, because while she likes to have fun, and believe me, Mary is absolutely hilarious, she takes the job of teaching foreigners Chinese extremely seriously. So what I want you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/ChineseTeacherMary, follow her, subscribe to her, come to her class, which is held 3 times a day. Support her and learn from her. Because I can almost guarantee you that after one lesson with Mary, you're going to realize that there is not a single teacher out there who is as dedicated to teaching as she is. Again, that's tinyurl.com/ChineseTeacherMary. Or just look for the link in the description. Hey there, D&Ders. Your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week. Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away. The police do get around to searching the Oldsmobile that Collins had owned during the time of a number of the murders. For all this, they end up coming up with some possible dried blood on the seat belts, which of course will be meticulously examined to see whether or not it matches any of the victim's blood. Now, Collins ends up standing for a lineup on the night of his arrest, August 1st. He is picked out from the lineup by the two women from the wig shop. Obviously, things are not looking good for Collins. What nobody is aware of, however, is that in California, where Collins had been not that long ago, police in Monterey County were paying attention to the suspect's arrest in Michigan. In June of 1969, a young woman by the name of Roxy Ann Phillips from Salinas, California, was found murdered in Carmel, California. What happened with Phillips was that in June of 69, She had met a man who told her that he was a student at Eastern Michigan University and that his name was John. He was driving an Oldsmobile Cutlass and also had several motorcycles. Her nude body ends up being found in a patch of poison oak on July 13th with a length of a red and white floral belt tied around her neck. A piece of this belt is going to end up being found inside a trailer that Collins and one of his friends had dropped at a property in Salinas on June 21st. They are also going to find a sweater inside of Collins's closet that had 22 pubic hairs on it, which matched Roxy Ann Phillips. Moreover, it's going to be learned in the ensuing years that during his trip to California, Collins had gone to a hospital to get treatment for poison oak. But all of that is in the future. At this point, they are just looking at this case and realizing that there's a very good chance that this man who has been arrested in Michigan may be tied somewhat to the crime that has taken place in their jurisdiction. And they do end up reaching out to Michigan and informing them of the murder that has taken place there, the circumstantial evidence that they have, which seems to indicate that John Norman Collins may in fact be the killer that they're looking for. Police in Michigan did ask California to see if they could run down the camper that Collins and his friend, a man by the name of Manuel, who was known to have committed burglaries with Collins, had brought out there. The trailer ends up being discovered on August 2nd behind a house in Salinas. So on the 3rd, members from the task force, including Crime Lab team members, fly out to California to check out this trailer. Now they learn that the house where the trailer was found was the home of Manuel's grandfather, who told police that the trailer had been brought there towards the end of June by his grandson and a nice-looking white male. The man further stated that they had been on his property from somewhere around the end of June to through the first week of July, and that after that they were back in Michigan. As for the California murder itself, a number of items having belonged to the victim were found on or around July 1st in various places, including a jacket with half of a bus ticket in it, a straw bag, a wallet with numerous pictures of young girls in it. On August 5th, investigators get a bit of a boon to their case when the results of the testing done on Collins's car, specifically on the seat belts and front seats, come back as positive for being type O blood from a human. Why is this significant? One of the victims had type O blood. They also found a small piece of clothing believed to have been part of the outfit that the California victim had been wearing when she was last seen alive on June 30th. On August 6th, Collins's friend and partner in crime, Manuel, was tracked down to Phoenix, Arizona, where he was charged with larceny for the fraudulent renting of the trailer that had been disposed of in California, along with possession of stolen property, as he was found to be in possession of numerous articles that had been stolen from a home in Ypsilanti. Once he was back in Michigan and officially charged, police began pressing Monty about what he might know concerning Collins's involvement in any of these murders, stating that he couldn't even recall ever having discussed the spate of crimes with Collins. However, he did state that on Wednesday, July 23rd, he had not seen Collins until late in the afternoon, around 4 or 4:30. This refutes the story that Collins had given to police about having been out with his roommate showing them how to ride motorcycles somewhere in the early afternoon hours of July 23rd when Karen Brenneman went missing and was murdered. He said that after Collins returned, they'd gone out for something to eat and spent the rest of the evening watching TV. And that Collins's demeanor did not seem different in any fashion following the 23rd. When questioned as to why he had taken off if he had no prior knowledge to any of the murders, Monty stated that it specifically had to do with the cop that had been around the house after the 23rd. He feared that the cop had come to the house in connection to the burglaries. He was given multiple polygraph examinations, which you know my thoughts on, all of which, according to court documents, he passed. Monty ends up getting a plea bargain in exchange for his cooperation in informing the police anything that he knew about John Norman Collins. Collins's other roommate was another matter altogether. Arnold Davis began telling the police of every single thing that he knew. Davis initially stuck to the 2:30 story that Collins had told him. However, after some pressure by police, he broke, stating that it probably had been later and that it was Collins who put the time of 2:30 into his head. He said that on the night of July 23rd at around 9:30, Collins had left, saying that he wanted to go work on one of his bikes, and had not returned until roughly 11:30 that night, before stating that he'd forgotten to go feed his uncle's dogs and left again, this time not returning until after midnight. He also told police that Collins had given him a 4-inch hunting knife on the night that Collins had disappeared with the mysterious box, stating that Collins had pulled it out from beneath the seat of one of his motorcycles and asked him to hold on to it so that the police could never find it. I also learned that Collins was a very accomplished thief, stealing motorcycle parts as well as entire motorcycles themselves. I learned that the Triumph that Collins had may in fact have been a stolen motorcycle that had been heavily modified by Collins, and that the plate that was brought to him on the day he was questioned initially by police in the garage was in fact a new license plate for this bike. And Arnold told the police that in the last few weeks, Collins had begun branching out in his burglaries, actually robbing homes, and that he seemed to get a perverse joy out of it that had nothing to do with financial gain. Police then brought him back to the motorcycle, specifically the day of the 23rd when Collins had taken him out riding, and it's from this they learned that Collins had taken him out on his green Triumph, and that before doing so, he had taken a round mirror off of the blue Triumph, which was still warm to the touch, and put it onto the other bike, as well as taking the license plate from the blue Triumph and putting it on the green bike as well. They also learned of Collins' voracious sexual appetite, with Davis stating that it was not unusual for John Norman Collins to bring two or three women back to his room during the course of a single night, and that while most of these had seemed like normal situations, on at least one occasion, a girl had come running out of Collins' room with Collins hot on her heels. When pressed on the girl's identity, Davis admitted that it could have been Alice Elizabeth Colomb. Police then asked Davis about the evening of June 30th, 1968, which, if you'll recall, was the night that Joan Espeth Shell disappeared. Shell was the young woman whose body was found in Ann Arbor, with the lower portion of her body remarkably well preserved, while the upper portion was badly decomposed. This is the young woman who was seen in Collins's presence by a number of people on the night of her disappearance. Davis stated that on that night, he, Collins, and another individual who was a friend of Collins's were driving around in this other individual's car. This other individual was driving. They went over to the student union, found a door unlocked, at which point Collins had attempted to call a girl that he knew. They were interrupted in this by the custodian. Driving around the block, they had seen two girls standing at a bus stop, and Collins had called out to both of them, with one of them coming up to the car and saying that she needed a ride to Ann Arbor. Collins had allowed her to get in the car beside him. At this point, Davis said that they drove back to the house on Emmett Street, and Collins informed the young girl that he would drive her to Ann Arbor in his own car. So Davis had gone into the house. The other individual had driven off, and Collins and this other young woman had gotten in the car. And it was not until roughly 1 a.m. before Collins showed back up at the house. He went into Davis's room and told him that they'd been parked in a Kmart parking lot making out, when the girl suddenly got frightened, demanded to be let out of the vehicle, and Collins had thrown her from the vehicle and driven off. In subsequent versions, Davis would state that Collins told him that he had driven her all the way to Ann Arbor. When officers asked Davis why he remembered all this, he recalled that when Miss Shell went missing, and it was all over the news, and pieces of the story started to come out, Collins had made it a point to tell him, Davis, that neither of them should discuss any of the coincidences between the two stories with anyone. Arnold Davis ends up going through a polygraph examination, which leads the examiner to determine that Davis had no known knowledge of the crimes, nor had he participated in any of them. With all of this, investigators start looking back over the cases at the witnesses and presenting them with pictures of John Norman Collins, trying to see whether or not any of them will pick him out as an individual that they had seen either with one of the victims or in the vicinity that a victim had disappeared. Many of these individuals would point to Collins as being the man that they had seen in or with or around one of these girls. They also got evidence that tied Collins to the rest of these missing young women who had all turned up murdered. In the case of Mary Fizer, they found a Expo 67 necklace that she was fond of wearing in Collins's dresser. They also had evidence from witnesses placing Collins in possession of a .22 pistol, which, according to Monty, he had sold just prior to fleeing the area in order to help finance his bus trip to California and then down to Phoenix, Arizona. Police are gonna get a lot of more circumstantial evidence against Collins in the coming days, including a boot print that was found on Collins' skirt that matched boots that Collins owned, the blood inside of Collins' car, as well as later discovered on a raincoat that he owned was also found to match Collins. Arnold Davis then gave police another version of events concerning the disappearance of Joan Elspeth Shell, stating that Collins had been carrying a red handbag when he returned on the night that Shell disappeared. He'd stated that Shell had left it in his car, but that he was going back to Ann Arbor the following day as he promised to give Shell a ride back to Ypsilanti. Davis would state that he always suspected that Collins had murdered Joan, but he was too terrified of his friend and roommate to go forward to the police with this information. And the police started getting more evidence that tied Collins to various murders. A former girlfriend of his told police that on the night of June 7th, she had had a pretty terrible argument with Collins. If you'll recall, that's the night that Shell went missing. Other people also placed Collins in the area around the square on the night of June 7th, further cementing to police that John Collins was in fact the perpetrator of all these murders. Now, I know some of you are thinking, well, they didn't have concrete evidence. We've discussed this before. Oftentimes in homicides, cases are built upon circumstantial evidence, and enough of it is found that authorities feel they can move forward with a case, then a suspect is then arrested and prosecuted, and that circumstantial evidence, although separately seemingly unrelated, is usually more than enough to bring about conviction. So at this point, beginning of August, the police are certain that they have the right man, that they have enough evidence to convict John Norman Collins of at least three of these murders, although they want to be able to eventually convict him of all. Collins, on the other hand, is not having any of it and is refusing to talk with the police. Initially, after being placed in solitary confinement, police had thought that Collins might talk to him, as he stated on August 2nd that he wanted to talk to somebody. However, after talking to his mother and then his legal counsel, the best that they could get out of Collins was a confession that he had helped steal the camper. Obviously, this pisses the police off to no end, as they had felt certain that he was on the verge of making a full confession. The preliminary hearing for John Norman Collins' trial is on August 7th, but it was not what anyone was expecting, as Collins' counsel announced to the court that they were withdrawing from the case at his request. Collins is then appointed counsel by the court. The original counsel was brought back by this court-appointed counsel on August 14th, when the actual arraignment hearing took place. And Collins is officially charged with the murder of 18-year-old Karen Sue Benjamin. We're actually going to end the episode at this point with the suspect in custody and a court trial looming in the not-too-distant future. We'll be back next week, where we'll actually conclude our coverage of the Ypsilanti Ripper crimes. Until then, stay morbid.